Esther 3. Esther 3, verses 10 and following. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. Now, as I've noted previously, Haman has demonstrated some association with Magi, which were a group of Persian fire worshippers who had a special affinity and alleged proficiency in astrology. They were those who desired to discover the future through the use of occult means. And Haman was seeking information that might help him in the executing of his plans for revenge against Mordecai. Taking advantage of the belief that the first month of the year was best for prognosticating about the events of the coming year, Haman apparently sat back and watched as another cast lots to see what would be the most fortuitous time to strike a blow. Not merely against Mordecai, but he's concerned to go against the whole of the Jewish people, at least that portion of the people that is scattered amongst the Persian Empire. And so it's through the casting of lots that we saw he has settled upon a solid date. So we need to understand both the day and the month that Haman has chosen has been determined by lot, by the casting of lots. Now, it shouldn't be thought such a strange thing, actually, that those who are engaged in astrology should place so much emphasis upon determining the correct day in which to undertake a serious endeavor. Now, people who are really intent in practicing astrology, they want to know, if they're going to cast your horoscope, they want to know not only the day, but the hour and even the minute of the hour, if you can give it to them, that you were born. They want to know as much as they can, because they feel that closer they can get. So there is in this occult art of astrology almost an obsession with how these things fit together with time. And it's all part of viewing what they view as a great unfolding or unfurling of divine purpose and placing your life or some event in its proper context in a much broader sense, in a sort of a cosmic sense. So this notion that one day might be more favorable and another day less favorable or unfavorable for various purposes, that notion is actually very far from unusual. In fact, this belief is common not only among the Persians, but to most, if not all, of the ancient peoples at this time. Now, previously, I mentioned a couple of reasons for noting that this casting of lots was during the first month, Nisan. And as mentioned, the name Nisan reminded the Jews of the Babylonian captivity, because they had adopted those Babylonian names sometime during that period of the captivity. However, there is another consideration for calling attention to this particular month. We've talked about this before, but Nisan, on the 15th day of Nisan, Nisan is the month of Passover, and the 15th day is the day for beginning that commemoration of the deliverance of the Jews from Egypt. If we understand what the Jews have understood about the Book of Esther, that in a sense Mordecai is a second Moses, a second only to Moses in bringing about the deliverance of the people of God, these connections then should not be viewed as being insignificant. They're very much programmatic. We should be reading this with this understanding. And so the news then that arises from this casting of lots is going to arrive, and we're going to see this really in the next chapter as the Jews are preparing for Passover. It arrives just in time to interrupt and dampen the usual festive spirit that would accompany that time of year. Now, to those whose eyes are blinded to the guiding hand of divine providence, Passover might seem like it's about to commemorate the plan that led to the total annihilation of the Jewish people throughout the Persian Empire. And I would suggest to you that if you were an unbeliever, that's how you're going to look at this. You're going to look at this as some sort of cruel cosmic joke that is about to unfold and is about to turn and pervert all that you held dear in remembering Passover. It's going to turn it all on its head. But for those who believe, we need to remember the words of Psalm 9, verse 16. The Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. Remember, the lot was cast before Haman. But Proverbs reminds us that the whole disposing thereof was of the Lord. And in casting this lot, Haman has actually set in motion a chain of events that will ultimately lead to his own destruction. But Haman doesn't see that yet. And neither do those unbelieving Jews as they hear the news coming out of the palace. Now Haman, having determined the best time to effect his plan through the casting of lots, he's come up with the 13th day of Adar. He now begins to lay what he believes to be the snare for the whole nation of the Jews. Right? He knows this is the day. In his mind, this is the date with destiny. Right? 13th of Adar, 11 months later. So furthest away in the year that you could go. They're in the first month, this is in the 12th month. So it's actually 12 months later. Haman sees this as the best time, and he thinks that, you know, fortune has smiled upon him, the lot has revealed to him this day. With that in mind, then, he begins to exercise what the Jews had referred to as his gift for evil speaking. And with a certain degree of cunning, he deliberately hides the identity of the targeted nation from the eyes of the king, whilst at the same time he's setting forth his case for the absolute annihilation, the total extermination of this people. And so what he does is he paints a picture. The picture he paints is one of a people that are both, or should be, if they're not, they should be despicable and understood to be subversive to the whole of Persian society. Furthermore, he wants you to understand that they pose a danger precisely because they're not all in one ghetto, but they've been scattered throughout the whole empire. And throughout the whole empire, they're exerting their own peculiar influence and following their own norms and all of that. They're a danger. They're maintaining their own laws. And furthermore, Haman is alleging to the king, these laws are at variance with Persian law. And so he's saying, in essence, these people are rebels against the laws of the king. And this cannot be let to stand. Now, the first charge is true. They are all over, right? They're scattered. But that's the native consequences of being a conquered people. What the Persians did is what most conquering powers throughout history have done. They habitually remove people from their homelands or even from temporary places to repopulate areas where they've conquered other people. So if you live in town A and you've been conquered by the Persians, they're going to take a large number of people from town A, and when they conquer town B, they're going to put those people in town B. And as they feel that you're more assimilated, they're going to take some of you, and when they get to town C and D and E, they're going to put you in those towns too. So they're dropping you here and there. This is what happens to a conquered people. So the longer you've been a conquered people, the more scattered you're probably going to be. That's just the nature of how they did this. So throughout the ancient Near East, many of the peoples, many of the national tribes and people found themselves forced migrants. And the Jews were no exception. And as people from remote portions of the Persian Empire were moved west, many of the Jews would have been moved east to fill up those populations. And as you conquer lands to the west, you want people that have been assimilated in your culture to go there and secure your claim there. You're going to then take people from those places and displace them into other places to fill up the population again, but they'll be put in places where their influence will not be felt. Now, the problem is, as the Egyptians found out, the Jews bred like rabbits. They were not antinatal in their philosophy. They believed in having children and as many as they could. And so, of course, the longer these Jews are in these populations, the more they are, in fact, expanding populations. But we need to remember, if the Jews are scattered, as Haman says, and undoubtedly they were, it was due to the Persian policy. It wasn't actually because there's any reason to believe there was a sinister plot on the part of the Jews. They're a conquered people, and this is what happens. Now, the second charge is also true, at least in some sense. They do have different laws. But before any judgment was made, it actually should have been considered by those who were in charge whether or not their laws were better or worse than those of any of the other nations. After all, the Persians generally allowed a conquered people to live by their own laws as long as they did not interfere with Persian law. And I would suggest that upon impartial examination, it might have been discovered by them that the Jews had laws most conformed to those principles of natural morality which every Gentile would be compelled to acknowledge was just and right. They had actually looked at it. It might have struck them as something perhaps worth saving, something worth conserving. Yet the charge that their laws were diverse or different from all the nations is really an indictment of the peculiar usages of the Jews which separated them from the nations. You know, the fact that they didn't eat pork. The heathen really viewed that as a very odd thing, that you wouldn't eat pigs. In fact, later on, when Antiochus Epiphanes goes into the temple and slays a pig on the altar and demands that the Jews eat it, he is shocked that he really can't get any response, can't get any takers. This made them seem odd. And the oddity of the Jewish usages certainly were more evident at times such as Passover, right? When you have Jews behaving in a manner wholly alien to the Gentiles. Killing a Passover lamb, and going through that Passover supper, and all of the things that went into celebrating Passover a rite, that was very odd. Now, the word that's used here, by the way, is a term for statutes. When it says their laws are diverse, it's for statutes rather than the typical term for law. It's a word that's also used of the laws or the statutes of the king. And so, and in fact, we've already seen this word used, and we will see it again in the book of Esther. What Haman is actually doing then is, by using this word, he's making clear the opposition he believes, at least, probably partly at least, rightly, to adhering the ordinances of the Jews toward the ordinances of the king. Particularly when the king's statutes or ordinances or laws are considered as religious claims, because the Jews are going to react in a very different way than everyone else. Now, the third charge, this idea that he has that they're rebels against the laws of the king, that's only tangentially true. Right? At least from what Haman knows firsthand. It's only tangentially true. And that's, I say, because he's only really experienced the resistance of Mordecai. Right? Only Mordecai, to his knowledge at least, has resisted this royal edict calling for men to bow down in reverence to Haman. And yet, his argument might have been along the lines of suggesting that this implied that Mordecai questioned the king's authority to place Haman in his position with his call for reverence. I mean, he could have followed that. He never really draws that out, but perhaps that's what he's really suggesting. Now, if he is doing this, and this I would say he's probably telling the truth, because those who were faithful Jews, those who were acting like Jews, showed themselves to be faithful covenanters who wouldn't resemble the groveling sycophantry of the courtiers. They wouldn't engage in civil acts that would constitute a pledge of fealty to an immoral civil government, especially when that government was encroaching upon the rightful claims of God over the consciences of men. In other words, faithful Jews refuse to engage in the civil idolatry which is all around them. They're not going to engage in it with everyone else. Now, this is then the most egregious sin against any claims to be the ordinance of God in an age when political dissent could call forth the wrath of an ungodly king. You know, to refuse to go along, that's an egregious sin. And that's really what Mordecai's sin is. We have an absolute sovereign, a despot, who is not ruling according to the ordinance of God, and have one man resist that, that's a threat to that kind of power. This is why despots become so desperate in controlling all of those under them. Because one leak in that chain of obedience invites everyone to cast off obedience, precisely because the obedience is not founded in any principle of natural morality per se. In fact, very often it's contrary to principles of natural morality. So what Mordecai is doing is subversive, it's revolutionary. But we don't really know that Haman or the king understand it to be just that. Nonetheless, it's for all of these reasons that Haman suggests to the king, these people are not safe for the king to allow to remain in his empire. Right? And the Hebrew actually says idiomatically that the king should not cause them to rest or to have rest. It's in the Hefel. So Haman's design is set in stark contrast to the approach of the Passover, which was a deliverance wherein God caused his people to rest from their slavery in Egypt. So this is another contrast that Mordecai, who I believe wrote this book, that he's giving us here. By saying this, then, Haman is being identified, and he's identifying himself actually with Pharaoh and positioning himself as an enemy of God and his people. Right? Haman is the one who's saying, give them no rest. Have them make more bricks, but we're not going to give them any more straw. Give them no rest. We're going to get blood from a stone from these Jews. So Haman is presented here then as rising to the level of obstinance against God and his people as Pharaoh. Now consider here the plan that's being hatched by Haman. Because of this astrological event tied to his casting of the lots, Haman actually believes that he is killing with God on his side. But there's someone else whose approval is equally, if not more, important to his designs, as he shows us in his actions here, and that is the king. You see, in the mind of the heathen, having the gods on your side is a good thing. It's a helpful thing. But it's not the only thing. No, you need the king's permission. Because ultimately, nothing that he wished to accomplish could be done, at least not on the scale that he would like to do it, without the king's approval and permission. Now, it may be, had he simply been content to see the demise of Mordecai, it may well be that he might have accomplished that without seeking divine permission or sanction. But even if he had, he could probably get away with it without going to the king. However, murder on the scale of genocide, which is what we're talking about here, was not going to escape the attention of the king. If you start killing every Jew, you're going to have a glut of empty houses, and someone's going to notice that there's a lot of work that used to be getting done, no longer getting done. For those like Haman, then, who are suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, it's a great lubricant for their conscience to take cover under the pretended authority of another when they want to perpetrate such a great crime against God and man. And I call it a crime because I want to emphasize there is no authority from heaven, and therefore there is no authority upon earth for such a mass extermination of people, especially upon the grounds that were being pleaded by wicked Haman. Called a crime because a government doing this kind of thing is actually giving grounds for people to rise up and overthrow such a government. Now I want you to think again about Haman's rise to power in the court of the king. It was followed upon the exposure of the plot of Bigthan and Teresh against the king. We're told in verse 1 it was after those things, after that exposure of that conspiracy, that the king Ahasuerus, or Xerxes as we know him in profane history, that he advances Haman to be seated above all the princes. Now, why does he do that? It does that in all likelihood because he had just had a breach. A breach within his inner circle. And the problem is, when you've got an inner circle where everyone is on the same level, no one's really in charge, and so no one's going to be responsible for what all the rest of them are doing. And that is where Haman comes in. With this promotion, the court, which had previously counseled the king, however, was placed in submission to one person, Haman. So that's the downside. The upside from the king's point of view is, I have better control because I have someone who's going to be the hammer. Downside is, those people who used to involve themselves in council, their voices are all going to be submerged. Where many voices had contended and brought various points of view when he was seeking counsel before that, different perspectives of counsel, it's now going to be only Haman's voice that will prevail. Haman's going to hear all of them, and he's going to do it. And so it's really this case of Mordecai and the Jews that he's going to use to seek to test the limits of his new political reach. How far can he go? And we're going to see the consolidation of this power, actually, in verse 10. But finally, I want to call to your attention one more time the great sum of money that was pledged by Haman for the destruction of the Jews. Although the precise amount is a matter of some dispute, and I suggested a very large quantity last time, an amount that was said to equal about two-thirds of the yearly revenues of the Persian Empire, there is something actually about this amount, the sum of the money, that was noticed by the rabbis. That is this. If we look at Ezekiel 45, verse 12, we can deduce that there were 60 minas in a shekel. So that the sum that was pledged, 10,000 shekels of silver, was equal to about 600,000 minas. Now, why is that? Why is that interesting? Well, the price paid for the redemption of the Jews, if we understand that the redemption money, the temple tax, according to Numbers, according to the Pentateuch, the price was that they were to pay a half a shekel. Right? That was the redemption money for the Jews. A half a shekel apiece, that was the amount of the temple tax. Well, that would have been about 300,000 minas for the Jews when they were brought out of Egypt. In Numbers 2:32, we're told that the number of children that came up out of Egypt was around 600,000. And so what this means is that Haman is actually offering twice the price that God had required for the redemption at the Exodus in order to secure their destruction at this time. So none of this is without purpose. How much the wickedness of the enemies of true religion should rebuke those who profess the true religion? Think about that. Haman not only sought the destruction of the Jews, he was willing to give a great deal of his own substance to see that this was accomplished. And yet, this stands in stark contrast to the disposition of so many who contribute little or nothing of their worldly substance to advance the cause of God and truth. And Haman is willing to give, you know, more than the widow's mite as a heathen to see the destruction of the church of God. He's going to double that price of their redemption. Now, whether he knew what he was doing consciously or not, the fact is, that's what he was doing. He was offering twice their redemption in order to bring them to destruction. So let's begin now looking at verse 10. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. The king took his ring from his hand. I want you to think about this. The king, Ahasuerus, he's heard the case set forth by Haman. Does he say a word? Not yet. The first thing we're told that he does is he acts. We're not told that he deliberates. We're not told that he goes to anyone else, that he seeks any other counsel. We're not told that he in any way is going to second guess, review, or check the information. Haman is the chief advisor. He's appointed him. Haman sits as the chief person through whom all other counsel must pass if it's going to reach the king's attention. And at this moment, in this event, we see, because of the king's confidence in his own choice in elevating Haman, Haman has reached the height of his position and power. The king isn't thinking about anything else. He just takes off his ring, a ring which he would have worn on his hand. And this ring, this ring is not just any ring. This ring, as the Hebrew word indicates, was his signet ring. Now, I don't know if you know what a signet ring is. Their use has been quite prominent down through history. During this period of time in the East, those who stood at the top of political power very often had signet rings, and they were made rings so that they wouldn't lose track of it. It was always with them. It was always on them. No one could get it from them without them being aware. That's why they're wearing it. This is not your typical piece of jewelry. This is not a point of vanity on their part. The signet ring was something they would dip in some substance, usually a red substance, and then impress upon all official documents and state papers. So they would dip it in ink or in some sort of material, that, a lot of times red because it would stain, you couldn't get it off very easily. And the stamp would ratify the document, or the law, the proclamation, whatever it was, as indicating it had all royal authority behind it, and therefore it was to be proclaimed and enforced. And later on in history, signet rings are used to press into hot wax to seal documents. But this ring then probably was just used by dipping it into something and then using it as sort of a stamp on a paper, on some sort of document. So the ring is used to seal or to make official whatever was impressed with its design. It would let you know this was from the hand of the king and from no other. Now, the unusualness of Ahasuerus' action, I think, can be seen if we contrast his action to Alexander the Great, who we know it was only a few hours before his impending death that he was willing to give up his signet ring to one of those closest to him. He never removed it until he knew he was dying and that he was literally hours from death. We know, likewise, the Roman Emperor Tiberius is said to have clutched his ring even in his dying breath. That's how important this was to maintaining power. And all of these heathen rulers, they understood this. And so it's very, very uncommon for the signet ring to depart from the hand of the sovereign for any reason. Because with that signet ring, you really do have the keys to the kingdom. You can ratify any document, and any government official in any province who sees that document ratified is going to proclaim and enforce it. Doesn't matter what it says. So the transference of this signet ring could lead to a lot of confusion in the realm if it was used without the king's knowledge and consent. That's why they held on to it so tightly. They knew that if they lost control of that, they literally could lose control of everything in the kingdom. However, the shakeup, evidently, that had followed the plot against the life of the king, Bigthan and Teresh, in the previous chapter, had led Ahasuerus to consolidate his council into the person of Haman, and now, to this one person, Haman, would be granted an attendant power unequaled and unsurpassed. So with this transfer, it seems that Ahasuerus inadvertently sentences his own wife to death, because Haman has nowhere disclosed that his purpose was against the Jews. And even if he had, as yet, there's no reason to think the king was aware of her lineage or her connection to the nation of God's people. We just don't have any reason to think that yet. The king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. Now, this transfer, as we're going to see, remains until the time of Haman's death. It's only with Haman's death that this is given up, this ring. So this giving was a gift, a grant. It's going to allow Haman to act, if he should so choose, he's going to be allowed to act without having to filter his actions through the king. Now, undoubtedly, from what we know about Haman, this is going to make Haman rejoice, and probably it's going to make his head swell with so much pride it's almost going to explode, right? He just has to be full of himself at the thought of what he can do now with this unbridled power. You know, I don't just have the keys to the new car. I've got the keys to the kingdom. I can take it anywhere I want now. I have the ability to ratify any legal document I want. And hey, if the king's distracted with something else, I'm probably not even going to need to bother saying a word. This is how much I think he trusts me. This is how much, in fact, he does trust me. But remember, it's the very fact that he failed to disclose this very important point, that we're talking about the Jews, that's going to come back to bite him. And all of that trust that the king has put in him because of his one deceit, all of that trust will dissolve in a nanosecond and end in his destruction. Now, before Haman swells up like a toad, he should have considered his ways, right? I mean, after all, he was intent upon making war against the people of God. What was this guy thinking? Hadn't he heard of Pharaoh and the Egyptians? Hadn't he heard the stories of what happened when people resisted these people when they were faithful? Didn't he know anything about this? You see, what he undoubtedly took as a sign that his idol gods were smiling upon his undertaking is just another example of the snare that's being laid for him in the providence of God. Had Ahasuerus taken direct participation in the decree, I want you to think about this now. Had he actually taken direct participation it would have made it much more difficult for him to change his course later on when Esther approaches him. But he doesn't. He never does. But think about this. It might have been that thinking that the king really wanted the Jews dead, when he does reverse his course later on, many of the people would have sided with the forces of Haman rather than the forces of the Jews when the decree goes out to allow the Jews to fight back. But you see, by the fact that he's given the ring to Haman, as Haman is swelling up with pride, he forgets. This actually creates another possible interpretation of events. The signet itself is going to make it difficult to rescind the order. Right? You can't just rescind this order because it's sealed by the signet. So the king can't just annul the decree at his whim. This is really setting up everything that happens later, providentially. Remember, if he had been allowed to rescind the order, rather than giving the Jews the right to fight back, they wouldn't have had the excuse they needed to utterly destroy their persecutors in the end. So this is cutting right down the middle, providentially. It's giving the king all of the necessary outs when it's time to reverse course. Everything that he needs is being left undone, and yet there's just enough done, and it's done in such an official manner that he can't simply annul it, because you can't just annul a law among the Medes and Persians. Now, we happen to know this is the case, and it's going to work out this way, because we have the complete record before us. However, for Haman, you know, all of this seemed to him, I'm sure, very fortuitous. And undoubtedly, it fed his ruthless ambition, and it no doubt stroked his unruly pride, thinking that he had God on his side, or his gods on his side. The king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Now the narrator of the story reminds the Jews at this point, very careful to remind the Jews of the character of the one who now has the power to destroy. Remember what I said several weeks ago, the name Hammedatha seems to mean magnificent or great, so that Haman is a descendant of a proud lineage. He is, in other words, the son or the child of pride. And as we know from the book of Job, Leviathan, which is a type of the devil, is said to be the ruler over the children of pride. Job 41:34, he beholdeth all high things. Speaking of Leviathan, he is a king over all the children of pride. This is signaling to us that Haman is the seed of the serpent. Nonetheless, though his spiritual father is the devil, he shall be made to serve the Lord. What the psalmist says in Psalm 76, verse 10, surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. God has made the wicked to fulfill his designs, even as they strive to fulfill their lust. Proverbs 16, 4, the Lord hath made all things for himself, yea, even the wicked, for the day of evil. Haman then has been set for the fall and for the rising again of Israel. And all things pertaining to this are being ordered by an inscrutable providence to bring this to pass. Again, Haman is called here an Agagite, a name that would stir up memories of the Amalekite king, who is the enemy of God's people par excellence. He is the prototypical enemy of the people of God. The one who, by the way, Saul has failed to kill. But Scripture tells us this war with Amalek which is a war with the seed of the serpent, it's going to be prosecuted until the last remembrance be exterminated from under heaven. And Mordecai, who is the son of Kish, he's a descendant of Saul, he is also a descendant of Kish, right? Saul's the son of Kish, Mordecai is a descendant of Kish. And so here's a second chance, as I've noted before, for the house of Kish to redeem the people of God. And this time, by the grace of God, it's going to come to pass. It's not the first Adam, it's the second Adam. And in bringing about the destruction of the people, the enemies of the people of God, we're going to see the final fate of all of the enemies of the people of God, of Israel. Now, the repetition of this diabolical pedigree no doubt encouraged the reaction of the Jews. Remember I said during the reading of Esther, during Purim, they would read it out loud, and when they heard the name of Haman, they were to blot out his name whenever it was pronounced. They were to make sure that his memory was blotted out. And that's because Scripture says the memory of the wicked shall rot. Haman is called the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and here now, very succinctly, the Jews' enemy. The word that's used here to describe the opposition of Haman is not the usual word, by the way, for enemy. Right? It means he is the one who vexes or harasses the Jews. That's what this word for enemy really means. He's engaged in a course of action designed to oppose with a measure of hostility all that is Jewish. Now, this is significant because it should be remembered here. The offense, if it was taken, the offense was only discernible in the previous actions of Mordecai, who refused to bow. And yet, here our narrator, who, as I said, I believe is Mordecai, he's indicating that Haman occupies a much broader character of one who not merely views Mordecai as an enemy, but that of all the Jews. Now, we're not told that if Haman discovering Mordecai to be a Jew, that he concludes all Jews must be like him, or if Mordecai's action only confirmed some already negative bias he had against the Jews. You know, we really don't know. The reason we don't, I think, is that the criminality of Haman's actions speak forth the unjustness of his thinking, whatever course it has taken. Haman doesn't stand condemned in the annals of Scripture because he had wrong thoughts with respect to the Jews, but because he actually acted upon those thoughts. A lot of people who hated the Jews over the years, they don't get singled out in the Bible simply for hating the Jews. It's not enough to get you memorialized like Haman. By the way, the rabbis say that the congregation of Israel was so shocked by the giving of the ring to Haman that they immediately began to repent. In fact, one Jewish authority, the Gemara, notes that this had a greater effect on Israel than 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses who had previously urged Israel to repent. It's only now, in the face of this event, that it's said that they turned to God for salvation and that they actually repented. So verse 11. The king said to Haman, "The silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee." The king said unto Haman, "Having heard the case as presented by wicked Haman," having already acted, right? He's already given him the ring. He already gave him the keys to the kingdom. But we're now brought to consider what one commentator, I think, very rightly is called the haughtiness of the king. And given what follows, not only does it seem right, it may actually not quite capture just how out of order Ahasuerus' behavior is. Nonetheless, Ahasuerus does at this point exhibit both an air of superiority over the situation as well as a certain amount of disdain for the problem presented. He never asked who or what. He's ready to sell an entire people into genocide on the say-so of one guy. But that shouldn't be a great surprise, since he's already elevated Haman at some time relatively recent to the discussion at hand. Why would the king, who'd only recently advanced Haman to such a place of honor, why would he now be inclined to doubt the report of this newly minted chief advisor? The answer, I think, is he really wouldn't. That would be like questioning your own judgment call, right? He's already given Haman the signet ring to use as he saw fit. So in light of all of this, his answer actually is going to be quite unremarkable, except for its demonstration of what was a very common habit among Eastern despots to place an implicit faith in certain courtiers who had gained their trust to this degree. The king said unto Haman, "The silver is given to thee." Now, some commentators assumed that the vast amount of money promised to the king for permission to annihilate the Jews would have been derived from the seizure of the property of the Jews after they had killed them, and then transferring it to the coffers of the royal treasuries. If that was the source of the money, then what Ahasuerus is telling Haman is, you know, you keep the money. On the other hand, it would basically make sense to see the king telling Haman the revenues that he's going to get from this pogrom would fall to himself as the king's favorite courtier, which he is for that moment, right? But since this scenario is not clear, what I think we can gather from this is this. The king is going to make one thing clear. He's happy with the plot or the plan, but he's actually declining the bribe. And he's telling Haman he doesn't want money in order to see this plot carried out. So Haman is willing to pay twice the redemption money to kill the Jews, but the king values them at nothing. Doesn't even want the money. However you look at this, he's saying, "I don't want the money." Not only does the king believe every word spoken by Haman, he does so without question, and the only thing he wants known is that he did not need any additional motivation like money to get him to go along with this plot. He's indicating by this that what he's really doing is seeking the good of his people. Now, while this might seem admirable, that an absolute sovereign is willing to take counsel from an advisor, the utter disdain, and there's no other word for it, the utter disdain for those to be subjected to Haman's wrath is on display here. Ask yourself, how can this king consign an entire population to destruction without even knowing who they are or what they'd actually done? I say what they'd actually done. Right, because Haman tells him a lot of things, but none of these are actual. These are all maybes. At this point, Haman, by his words, his mere words, he's managed to turn the whole apparatus of the Persian state against the Jews at no real cost to himself. At least, I'm sure that's what he was thinking for the moment. So we see he's getting hoisted up higher and higher. silver is given to the people also. So not only does the king dispense with any need to give him money for this plot, he also gives a clear verbal authorization for Haman to take possession of the people that he had described. I'll just point out, with this clause, we see how these despots, these absolute sovereigns, actually operate. They actually believe themselves to have rightful possession of those who are under their rule. They perceive themselves to be the total owners of men's bodies, and by the way, under some of these regimes, they would say of their souls as well. The Persian people, both native and subjugated people, were, in Ahasuerus' estimation, simply the king's property, and he now gives title to the group that was described by Haman in order for him to carry out his wicked designs against them. That's what's going on. Now again, notice the king never asks who they are, nor does he ever inquire as to the actual scope of their crimes. All of Haman's charges against them have been generic. There's nothing specific. It's all a maybe. It's a maybe, maybe, maybe. In fact, if he had to specify, we would only be talking about Mordecai. The only specific crime, if we can call it a crime, is that action of Mordecai. Nothing else. He has nothing else to fall back on. These are all insinuations. Now, the king's utter disregard of the identity of the people in question is, as mentioned, indicative of the spirit of his rule. Nevertheless, and this is important, the anonymity of the people will providentially prove to be a very important component when the plot is unveiled to the king by Esther. It allows for an element of surprise on his part, and this in turn creates the room for issuing a contrary decree allowing the Jews to fight back. Again, we see how each point here, the providence is so sublime. And yet, it demonstrates tremendous wisdom. The people also, to do with them. At the transfer of authority over this people, this population is broad-based. They're placed in the hand of Haman for him to do with them. He ceded his authority to be the ultimate judge of the disposition of the future of this people. By the way, who is he like in this? Handing them over to Haman that he may do with them. Isn't he a lot like Pilate washing his hands when the Jews called for Christ's crucifixion? Now, the Jews are going to make the same mistake with Christ that Haman is, or that Ahasuerus is doing here with Haman. Ahasuerus is actually washing his hands of any involvement in what's to come. That's what he's doing. He certainly knows the intentions of Haman, and he's here expressing no inclination whatsoever to stop it. In fact, he's granted Haman nearly complete control over them. All that he's awaiting now is the final solution. Silver is given to ye, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. Literally, Hebrew says, as it's good in thy eyes. So here's the king. He's suspending his own judgment upon that of Haman. That's how much disdain Ahasuerus has here. So in full display, these people are traded off into the hand of his chief advisor as a reward of loyalty with an expectation that he'll take care of the problem that he's discovered. Remember, that's what happened last time. He didn't have someone, and it just so happened this plot with Bigthan and Teresh was discovered. Now here's Haman acting proactively, evidently, and the king is very responsive. He wants to encourage this. His attitude actually seems to be if the innocent perish together with the guilty, it's of little concern to him. The only concern Ahasuerus is showing here is that the circle of the royal court remains secure. I don't want that Bigthan Teresh thing to happen again. See, everything in the book of Esther is deliberate. So verse 12. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month. Again, our narrator, Mordecai, is quite aware of the date. Why? Well, this date corresponds, as we see, to the day in the 12th month, Adar, when the plan was going to be executed. What's interesting is this, and remember, they've discovered this date, this day and month, but the day itself was discovered by casting of lots. The 13th day of each month was called by the Persians Tir, which means lot, or share, or part. And the name Tir had reference to the moon, which had for its symbol an arrow. Now, among the ancient people, including the Jews, the arrow was a symbol of death, or sickness, or disgrace, or blasphemy. In fact, It was a Persian saying that to shoot one with an arrow signified to wish one evil or to slander someone. So the Jew's death warrant is sealed on the day of the arrow in the first month, Nisan. But there's also something very notable. This is a day before the slaying of the Passover lamb. Exodus 12:6, you shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, it's the month Nisan, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. So this is going to cast a dark shadow over their remembrance of deliverance and raise questions about their future prospects. This is what happens when a people sin and enter into the depths of sin. This is the result of their backsliding, that their very redemption is going to be turned into a point of questioning and cast their faith into doubt. Now the king's scribes there were those who were charged to execute and writing the orders given by the king. That's what scribes did. They wrote down. The purpose of gathering all of them appears to be the whole lot of them is needed because they have to render into writing the orders that Haman is giving for all 127 provinces of the Persian Empire, plus, as we'll see. And there was written according to all that Haman had commanded under the king's lieutenants. So the emphasis here is not on the scribes, but on their writing. Because the scribes are not the ones giving the order. We don't really care that it's the scribes so much as the fact that they're under orders or just writing what they're told to write. The order was, as the king had conceded, the designs of Haman. And that's emphasized in this clause. Now, this order, we're told, first of all, was going to be sent to the 20 satraps. That's what it means by the king's lieutenants. The 20 satraps are commanders. They're called here the king's lieutenants. These are the chief administrators over the whole of the empire. So there are 20 chief administrators. And then we're told into the governors that were over every province. So now you have to write to these governors of the 127 provinces. Those were revenue districts of the empire. And these are secondary administrators who would give answer to the satraps. And then we're told that they also had to send this writing to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof. So this writing is going to be sent to all the princes. It says rulers, but the word there is princes of each of the various peoples gathered under the Persian rule. Now, who are these princes? Well, as I've mentioned several times, the Persians allowed you to have a certain amount of local sovereignty. And so these princes were actually the leaders that were chosen from among the various subjugated peoples or provincial peoples who would interact with the governors of the revenue districts, who in turn then would interact with these satraps, and they would answer to the king. Now, we're told here that each letter was written to reflect the peculiar style of the writing of each group. So the scribes, not only are they taking down what Haman says, but they have to do it in a manner that's going to be familiar. And then we're told, and to every people after their language. So, more importantly, the scribes are listening to what Haman is saying, but they have to translate this into all of the languages of the empire. They have to get it into the native tongues of the people unto whom these letters are being sent. They're doing this so that there's no room for misunderstanding or failing to get the message, even down to the lowest ranks of the people. It's going to be the duty of each local ruler, each local prince, to see that what was made known in his administrative district is enforced. So now we're talking about, you know, writing this out at least 300 times. Okay? And probably more. That's why they need all these scribes. Finally, we're told it was written in the name of King Ahasuerus. In the name of King Ahasuerus was it written? Well, yeah, the writing has every mark of genuine authority. If you're of the mind that authority is only a matter of providential possession of power, that is. You know, the king Ahasuerus has authorized these actions against the Jews without even hearing their side, or at least Mordecai's side. Against wisdom, you know, Solomon says in Proverbs 18:17, he that is first in his own cause seemeth just, but his neighbor cometh and searcheth him. So this is foolishness. And it shows us here that Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, he doesn't represent a moral constitution of government. Scripture says rulers are to be just and wise, ruling in the fear of God. He has none of this in his character. None of it there. And his lack of genuine authority is actually being transmitted in these writings. Finally, we're told that they're sealed with the king's ring. Writing is finished. What does Haman do? He now takes this ring, signet ring, and he affixes a seal of the king's signet to each and every document. And that is investing it with the full authority of the royal throne. This is then the ratification of the Jews' death sentence. All that awaits, at least from the point of view of Haman and the other bureaucrats, all that awaits is its execution. Now, we need to bring it to an end here. So I would just say in conclusion, we see in all of this that entrenched bureaucracy lends itself to wicked ends when executive powers are granted on too broad a basis. There are no checks, there are no balances in this system. There's only a top-down imposition of the will of the sovereign, for better or for worse. And in fact, it's the passive obedience of the lesser magistrates and the passive obedience of the people themselves that demonstrates their complicity in this evil plot against the church and people of God. And yet, as we know, this weakness is also going to prove to be the means by which God brings deliverance to his people when the time is right. Remember, the true God alone knows how to bring good out of evil, just as he alone is able to command light to shine out of darkness. And the story of Esther reminds us of the story of the struggle of the church militant in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. In all of this, in all of the speaking of Haman and the chattering going on as they're transmitting this wicked decree, it's often easy to get lost. Loud talk, loud actions of the wicked, very easy to distract us and get us off course. It's much better to quietly await the counsel of God, as we saw in Psalm 46. It's It's in quiet that we're able to hear the still small voice of the divine. And that's what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 9:17. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Amen.